smiling with his eyes. 'Tis joy what they can never give when I'm to organize. When I'm to
All right, Houston, welcome to this week's special edition of the Houston Indie Media Show. God, you know, I've heard that song for years and years and years, and even to this day, I still get goosebumps every time I hear it. In some ways, it's a song that kind of helps us with the struggle, but at the same time, it can be a sad song as well. But anyway, with us in the studio this evening, and the reason that we played that particular song by Joan Baez, singing about IWW songwriter and organizer Joe Hill, Adela and Tyler, two local IWW organizers and activists here in Houston. We're going to spend the show this evening going over all things IWW, but before we get into a lot of what is going on today, really want to kind of touch a little bit about the history of the IWW. There are a lot of folks listening that may not know what the IWW is. You know, what does IWW stand for? And so with that, I'll open it up. Tyler, you want to kind of give us a brief history, or however you want to do it, of the IWW. What is the IWW?
Oh, well, thanks for having us on, John. I appreciate that.
Hey, man, my pleasure.
And shout out to V on the boards. Nice song. All we need now is RZA to remix that song, and we'll have it right.
No doubt.
So IWW, okay. IWW, it stands for Industrial Workers of the World. It was a union founded in 1905, largely by folks that were kind of dispossessed by the mainstream unions of the time, which was the American Federation of Labor. So that included people of color, black folks, immigrants, women, and as well as the unskilled. These were basically all folks that the majority skilled white kind of labor aristocracy union, the AFL, refused to organize at the time. And so these are folks that took it upon themselves to create their own forms of organization and struggle. But, you know, like, it wasn't, I think one of the most important things about the IWW, it was not just different in terms of the race, gender, sort of national composition, but also their choice of strategy and tactics.
What was the, or how would you describe the environment at the time that the IWW was formed? What was the state of the labor movement at that time? What organizations were out there struggling or beginning to bring up this issue of workers' rights and a lot of those issues?
Mm. That's a really good question. I think you know, looking at the kind of broader political environment, so you had the emergence really of the United States as an industrial kind of empire, right? And, you know, just coming out of the Civil War, a lot of labor in the country had been sort of recomposed, especially, you know, post-slavery. A lot of slaves fled. Freed slaves fled the South, took up a lot of industrial work in the North, as well as you know, some of the expansive industries in the West. So in a sense, it was a time of like really, really profound change, you know. But there was, I think, a real absence of at least formal structures for this kind of new emerging working class at the time that was largely becoming more industrial, that was gradually beginning to be de-skilled in a certain sense. and the entrance of new kinds of people into the formal like workforce. And so I think, you know, like one of the more characteristic kinds of struggles of the time were mainly populist movements, you know, were largely kind of like land-based and, you know, organized folks who worked in the fields into sort of like broad-based campaigns to fight against a lot of the like big landowners as well as the banks. But it didn't really have like a consistent kind of class character the way a lot of like later labor organizations would eventually come to look like. I don't know what maybe some other stuff that I left.
Well,
out.
I think it's kind of interesting, you know, when you get these organizations like the IWW, okay, formed in, I guess the formal formation in 1905, but a lot of the key organizers, for the IWW were already involved in the early labor movement, but a lot of these folks also came out of the early socialist movements. Mm-hmm. And I bring this up only because I think sometimes the even when mainstream media or mainstream historians talk about history, too often they don't want to talk about the true nature of a lot of the movements. And the IWW, I think sometimes folks forget, was formed by some of the early socialist thinkers, anarchist thinkers that were involved in the labor movement and at that time, and decided that because of the kind of the issues that you talked about, the strategy for organizing wasn't, there was a disagreement. And that there was a better way to do this. And so, like everything else, radical, after a lot of struggle, we have the IWW, you know, being formed in 1905. We could spend a day talking about the IWW and the history and the characters that that were involved with it. But maybe if y'all could pick out one or two examples of the struggles that they were involved in, and maybe two or three of the key folks that are, besides Joe Hill, that are identified as early IWW organizers, and the IWW also known as the Wobblies.
I think you know, a couple of like the more sort of well-known historical battles that IWW played a very, you know, like key sort of leadership roles in. I think one would be and these couple of examples kind of occurred in a similar period. So around the lead up to World War I in 1917, you had a miner strike in Butte, Montana, that Frank Little, who was a IWW organizer from Oklahoma, he basically, like a lot of IWW organizers at the time, just, you know, traveled the country, taking roles in various fights and agitating. And so subsequently his last battle was in Butte, Montana. Ultimately he was killed there. But it was a very, very, I don't know, valiant struggle that he played an important role in galvanizing. And I think, I don't know, I think it reflected a lot of the, I don't know, a lot of like the struggles of that period, you know, because you had like the lead up to World War One, and so basically, you know, the U.S. government is like, you know, involved like in a real campaign to drum up support for that war, you know, and obviously right. It takes a very nationalistic sort of bent, right? And so the company Anaconda, who owned the mines in Butte, Montana. You know, one of their tactics, which was typical of companies, was to say that this was a conspiracy by the Germans, basically, to disrupt our American way of life, you know, rather than like, a very organic, homegrown effort of everyday people. So I think that was definitely one key. I think another one would be the waterfront struggles that happened on the Philadelphia docks around the same time. Black Wobbly, by the name of Ben Fletcher, was an important part of the struggles that happened there. One of the most telling things about it was that a lot of the Wobbly struggles on the docks in Philadelphia at that time were not necessarily with unorganized workers. A lot of the unorganized workers were black workers. They were brought in as strike breakers, you know, a similar tactic
right.
that companies would use. But some of the white workers were represented by the ILA.
Right.
And so theirs was a kind of like, in a sense, you know, it gets used very much in a pejorative way, but a kind of like dual union effort.
Right.
To displace, you know, a more kind of like company union and bring in something that not only fought it for the interests of the represented workers at the time, but also those who weren't, which were, you know, black workers.
And, you know, when you bring up the struggle on the docks, I think sometimes folks forget it, and maybe because there wasn't a struggle here that had the notoriety of other areas, but there was an IWW presence on the Houston docks. As a young high school radical, I had the opportunity to meet a couple of surviving Wobblies that at the time when I met them, I had a bar on Harrisburg near what was the old Hughes Tool plant and is now the Metro Yard. But I really look back at that now and realize how important that meeting was, and wish I'd had the time to talk a little bit more with these guys. And the building that housed the Houston IWW is still standing, remodeled a couple of times now. I think it's a church, but it is blocks from the docks. It is blocks from where the current dock workers unions are.
Very cool.
Yeah, so that presence was here, and hopefully someone someday will write a little bit more of an extensive history of the IWW here in Houston. But anyway, again, you know, we could talk a long time about that. But the reason for kind of wanting to lay the groundwork is because, you know, the IWW isn't dead. Maybe it's had its ups and downs since the early 1900s, but lately there's been a lot of activity by young IWW organizers, and that's what the next thing we're going to talk about. So maybe y'all can share a little bit about what the IWW locally what's going on, and if we have time, even touch on some of the struggles nationally that the IWW in the last couple of years or so have been involved in.
Yeah, definitely. You know, this conversation has really got me thinking about where the IWW was and kind of where it's become in this conversation about it emerging as a way to deal with labor that's kind of outside of the traditional labor struggle that was happening. So black folks, women, all these people that kind of fall outside of that white worker framework. And I think that's still very much needed today. And what is so attractive about the IWW today? So like one thing that we want to do in Houston is have a focus on immigrant labor. And obviously undocumented labor is very overlooked by unions today and historically. But I think in the South and in Houston and Texas, it's very important, to take up immigrant struggles and you know, specifically the role that they play in labor in Texas. It means that they're, you know, they've stolen wages, long work hours, all of these kind of like brutal working conditions that they face, is really profound in the South. So I think that's one thing that we want to focus on today, which lives on with the legacy of the IWW.
Yeah. I have a question for y'all real fast. You mentioned this for a second, you said women, so I'm wondering, how does gender play into all this? And then are there any non-male identified people that you could talk about?
Yeah, I think it's certainly today. You know, historically, you know, we've taken a lot of inspiration from the, you know, I guess one sort of historical anecdote. When you hear a lot of folks, like historians, talk about the IWW, like historically, they'll say, well, it was, you know, the first union to organize women, for instance, right? But I think it kind of inverts what the reality was, which was that women really organized themselves. And I think that that history, I guess sort of retelling that history in that way is really important, because it puts like women in the driver's seat of their own history and their own struggle. And I think that today, certainly in a lot of the industries that you certainly do have efforts by, you know, like the SEIU, UFCW to organize, for instance, among low wage retail, fast food workers, where like a lot of like women, you know, have found themselves. And, you know, so there, in one sense, there is a, you know, an effort on that behalf, right? But it comes up against, like, immediate limitations. And I think one of those is that, like, the SEIU, for instance, although I think the way that, like, me and Adela have talked about it and other IWW folks here in Houston is that they've really spoken to a desire of everyday people to sort of fight against their conditions at work, you know, to fight for higher wages, to, like, live better. And so that's great. And so you're seeing this kind of spontaneous energy emerge as a response to that, people walking out, you know, on their own without really, you know, without them really feeling like forced to or something like that. It's not like the union, you know, today, if you're represented by a union and they tell you to go on strike, you go on strike, right? So that's really important. But I think one of the limits that it comes up against is few of these unions are really, business unions are really prepared to respond to a lot of the very gendered conditions of work, right? So a wage increase, that's great. And I think like women stand to gain from a wage increase, right? But the wage increase itself doesn't address the disparity, for instance, between the differential in wages between men and women, right? It doesn't address sexual harassment that occurs at work, right? And, you know, the issue of sexual harassment is not just something that you address, you know, through the, you know, existing like legal channels, right? You know, I think what we really have thought about in terms of the relationship between the existing union efforts to organize around fast food and the, you know, sort of broader question of gender inequality in this country is that, you know, we would really like to see, you know, everyday women combine efforts to organize against the conditions at work, right? And to fight those very, like, you know, gendered aspects of it. So not just in terms of the wages, but also in terms of, like, specific kinds of work they're expected to do, harassment they might get from the boss or customers, et cetera. Because that's not just an individual issue. Like, I think as we understand it, it's very much a class question.
Right. So kind of with that said, then kind of getting back to the point of our, I guess, that we were talking about locally, where does that put us locally? You know, kind of trying to bring it back and some of the work that's going on.
I mean, to kind of piggyback off of that, I think something that the IWW also has been involved in is helping to organize people like sex workers, or here locally as part of immigrant struggles would be organizing around detention centers, which house obviously women and children. And so I think that would be a major component of gender struggles around labor.
So when you talk about, I think you talked about the current effort of organizing undocumented workers and the traditional labor unions, mainstream labor unions have vacillated a lot on that. You know, for a period, a lot of unions were even actively against it. Then maybe for it. It was just seemed like it was kind of, okay, what's ever in their interest, not what's in the interest of undocumented workers. So when you talk about doing that, how does that, how is that done? Is it done like maybe outside of shops or industries that hire a lot of undocumented workers? Does it include day laborers? And, you know, how do you see putting, organizing, working with undocumented workers into practice, I guess? How does that happen?
That's a good question. I mean, I think all those you listed are really good examples. You know, those are places where, you know, existing labor unions really aren't. Certainly, there are a number of NGOs and nonprofits that relate in some way to sections of immigrant workers. However, you know, valid though they may be, they do play more of a kind of like service relationship. So whether it be in the form of legal advocacy or, you know, support, you know, the reproduction of their needs and stuff like that. But there's a real dissonance between the role that NGOs play and, you know, the need to sort of like struggle against the existing conditions.
Right.
You know, and mind the organizing traditions of which, you know, immigrants come from very, you know, very diverse,
right,
you know, class struggle
and
traditions.
And that's like almost a topic that we will definitely want to continue. But before we run out of time, we also want to talk a little bit about some of the United Steelworkers support work. I saw one of the best pieces and analysis of labor, of a labor struggle that I actually had seen in quite a while, that was written by, primarily Adela. You did all of that work. And so maybe you could sum up in a couple of minutes, you know, kind of where that whole issue with the USW is. And before we even get into that, real quick, where can folks find out more about Houston IWW? There's tons of stuff written and on the internet about the history of the IWW, so we don't need to go into what you can do, but you can Google all day long IWW, Joe Hill, Big Bill Haywood, and some of these other folks. But
well, I think, you know,
local, I mean, today, where can folks go and kind of keep up with what you guys are doing?
Locally, it's pretty easy. You know, you could find us on Facebook, Houston IWW, okay. facebook.com/HoustonIWW.
All right.
I think a really important blog that has been a real resource for reflecting on contemporary organizing lessons is it's called Recomposition, which is an IWW blog. It's recomposition.info.
Okay.
That's
all right,
a great
well,
resource.
We will leave it at that, and we'll put some of the links on our Houston Indie Media Facebook page. We will also have the show on there, I guess, sometime soon in the next day or so. So folks can go back and listen to this. But anyway, real quick, before we run out of time, the USW.
Yeah, so I think in the piece that you're referring to was kind of a reflection of the local IWW's role in trying to build something with workers who are on strike for the USW. And I think part of it comes from an analysis of unions today not really being able to wage a significant struggle on behalf of the class, and partly because, or mainly because, they're beholden to the ruling classes. And so there's a breakdown of that that I won't really get into right now. I'll try to get into some more of the practical stuff that we were trying to do. So so basically, we were trying to approach it in a way that we weren't just going out and kind of symbolically supporting striking workers by, you know, holding signs and things like that, which is great. But how can we, as workers, come together on a practical basis to fight together, to support each other? And so we had been... you know, for a while we've been messing with this idea of having some kind of cross-industry network that basically would mean, like, I work in my job, you know, you work in your job, they're working in the refineries. So how can we, whenever we have certain kinds of grievances at our job, how can we support each other and use direct action to put pressure on our bosses. And so we went out there and we would talk to workers about this idea, like, hey, the USW is not willing or able to do certain things like preventing scabs from crossing the lines, disrupting. I mean, even pulling out enough workers to make a serious difference. And so how can we kind of strategize and think creatively about how to do those things? And the idea really resonated with a lot of workers. I think we met one worker in particular who's very important to this process, because he was very kind of naturally, like, I guess, radical, and not politically radical. Politically, he identified as conservative. But he wanted to, block entrances. He wanted to do more radical things than the USW was willing to do. And he told us about this group called Maticorp, which is basically a strike-breaking organization. They provide workers for companies who have their workers going on strike. They provide different resources. They leave that kind of vague, but different resources. So they were providing strike breakers for the refineries when workers were on strike. And when we started doing some research on them, we learned that they were also helping to smash the rebellion in Ferguson. And at the time in Houston, as many people know, there was a lot of activity around anti-police brutality that kicked off around Ferguson. And there was developing, and still exists, this really diverse group of people who are organizing against police brutality. So they had come with us to the picket lines, and we had this, I don't know, just profound moment of, wow, there's this connection between Black struggle and worker struggle that is kind of organically emerging and could potentially, like, go somewhere. So we wanted to try to see where that could go. And unfortunately, we weren't able to really get it off the ground because of a lot of internal debates about, what does a small group of radicals do when people are striking? How do you respond to that? We wanted to do the direct action. Other people were like, no, we can't. So we kind of just dropped the ball. Yeah.
Well, I think part of a learning process out of that is what we need to do to deal with those issues. You know, and if it was an easy question, it would have been done a while back. And there would be more success to show for it. So I think that this whole issue, maybe the groundwork's being laid, but because of work that you guys are doing, it's still a work in progress, but it has to go on. Once again, want to thank both Adela and Tyler for taking time out of their busy Friday evening to come spend it here with us on the Houston Indie Media Show. Want to thank everyone, V on the boards, myself, and the rest of our collective. Appreciate week to week tuning in. And once again, thank everyone that contributed and pledged to our show this last pledge drive. And that's what keeps us to be on the air, to be able to bring shows like this, because we know that there is no other outlet for the IWW.
That's right.
So with that, once again, thanks a lot, guys. Appreciate
thanks
it.
Thanks for having us.
Hey, our pleasure.
It's great to fight for freedom with a rebel.
That's it for our show. Don't hate the media, be the media. Peace.
Your friends may be hardened from labor, and our dress may not be very fine.
Tap your toes to music legends during the Sounds Like Houston Thursday concerts presented by UHD at Discovery Green this summer. Every Thursday night, enjoy free outdoor concerts showcasing the best musicians from Texas and the Gulf Coast. This series offers something for fans of every music persuasion, from legendary blues to dynamite Texas soul and funk. This week, enjoy tunes from Tejano legend, accordionist, and two-time Latin Grammy winner David Lee Garza y Los Musicales, Houston's own Tex-Mex rock and roll accordionist Roberto Rodriguez takes the stage beforehand. Concerts begin at 6:30 Thursday night. Most street parking is free starting at 6. Picnic, blankets, and lawn chairs are welcome, but glass containers and alcohol